From Johannesburg to Jerusalem, the world is always changing, growing and innovating. Join Benji Shulman for the next hour as he brings you the trendsetters, the thought leaders and those creating news before it happens. Only on the New Blue Review, your favorite Jewish culture and current affairs show. Every Monday at 9 a.m. right here on 101.9 High FM.
You're listening to 101.9 High FM. I'm Benji Shulman. This is the New Blue Review. Welcome to the show on this Monday morning. And I have a whole show that we are going to be doing for you today. I hope that you had a great weekend, that you've been enjoying the jacarandas. I was talking about the jacarandas on another show a couple of days ago, and everybody got super excited, and we're talking about white jacarandas, all sorts of things. So that is fantastic, and they are, even if you're just checking out the purple ones, really looking at some really great, just great views of Johannesburg, really, that that we have, and we can be grateful for it wherever you are listening to us. So that is what is out there. So we are going to, what are we covering on the show today? We're going to be doing a few things. We're going to be talking about the New York City elections. Zoran Mamdani. We're going to talk about Zoran and his possible mayorship in New York. We're going to be talking about Doctor, I think her name is, you pronounce it, Lacheng Mofokeng, and the problems that she has found herself in. We're going to talk about that. We're going to be talking about Israeli chips in NVIDIA, and we're going to be talking about UCT and the work that is going on there, because there was a big court case that was happening all of last week, and I'm sure we'll find one or two other interesting things to throw in there for the show today. If, as always, you want to contribute to the show, you are, of course, more than welcome. 061-895-1019. That is the WhatsApp line, and we will take any of your inputs that we have. Craig will send them to us because he gets all of those messages. So, yeah, that is the lineup for today. It's going to be a good one, and we're looking forward to being with you for this entire time, as we always do on a Monday morning. So, yeah, what can we talk about? What should we talk about first? Let's start with Mamdani, because he is going to be the big news story of this week, one way or another. And if you haven't heard anything about him, well, get ready for the download, because here it comes. This is what he is all about. So it is the New York City mayorship race, and New York City typically has a long time. It's a highly Democratic, basically. Very rare that you get a Republican, and even the Democrats that you do get tend to be more Republican, or at least they were traditionally. So if you go back into the 80s and 90s, you had guys like Ed Koch and Mark Bloomberg in the 90s. These were also people who were sort of more to the right, but they were still Democrats. And they were out there. But they also have a history of also putting in very left-wing mayors as well. And these sorts of things have connected together on the way that the city has operated. If you were around in New York in the 70s, 80s, not that I was, but if you read some of the histories, the image of New York was that it was crime infested and unsafe and economically down. If you ever watched a movie called Escape from New York, and there's a couple of others in that genre, all kind of represent the city as a dark, dangerous place that you don't want to be. And then you had this period where Mayor Rudy Giuliani took over at some point, and he was a kind of tough on crime mayor. If you've ever heard of the broken windows theory about how to do crime, and his theory was that do crime prevention. His theory was that what you do is that you actually have you clean up small issues, basically. That was his whole theory. And if you clean up small issues, then it will be the bigger issues will sort themselves out. Controversial theory, but theory nonetheless. And New York now, these days, you think of it as bright and shiny, although during COVID it did have a few issues. But it's, you know, the place where you go for fun times. And basically what happened is that New York had this change. And now they went through, after Bloomberg in particular, who was another kind of famous mayor, we went through a period where there were more kind of socialist mayors. There was a guy called de Blasio for a while. And then a guy took over by the name of Eric Adams. And Eric Adams is a kind of a sort of opportunistic kind of a mayor. He was originally a sort of, not defund the police, but he made his name as a sort of anti-police policeman, if you like. And then he came on as sort of made himself the mayoral candidate on the basis that he was going to get the crime problem down because he was, you know, because he had been in the police. That was kind of his shtick. You know, it's very opportunistic, but the truth is he is also just a moderate. He tried to fix some things more competently, less competently. Not everyone, he kind of was kind of seen as a bit of a clown sometimes, but you know, whatever, like you sort of took what you could get. And he ran the city for one term, and he was basically a shoo-in to get to the new mayorship. But then he had a bit of a corruption issue, and he was convicted of corruption by a prosecutor because he had taken some kind of bribe of some description from Turkish Airlines, of all people. It's something to do with like seat upgrades. I don't know. But basically he was convicted. And now he sort of has a problem where he could have run, but that became a bit of an issue with his base. The one thing which was absolutely unacceptable, which was he got pardoned by Trump. Trump actually pardoned him. But basically he was pardoned by Trump. And in New York state politics, which is in city politics, which is so heavily Democratic, that just is not acceptable. You're not going to get anywhere. And so he was basically cut out of the Democratic race, and he decided he was going to run as an independent. And this opened up the race for new challengers to come in and actually start to see if they could do something else. So that is where we're going to leave for a second. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking about then what happened next in the New York mayoral race. I'm Benji Shulman. This is 101.9 High FM.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 High FM. I am Benji Shulman, and on the New Blue Review today, we are just reviewing what is going to happen next. I think it's Tuesday our time, or probably late Tuesday our time. They can start voting in the New York mayoral race. And what is the likely outcome? And what I'd done just before the break was to talk about how we got to this position. And basically, the incumbent mayor, this mayor, Eric Adams, he had to pull out, run as an independent. And that left the Democratic ticket open for people to challenge. And a bunch of people challenged, but really the two people that came out were the following. The first was a guy called Andrew Cuomo, who had been the governor of New York State. So the, in other words, the state that surrounds the city of New York. Basically, it's like the Gauteng to Johannesburg, except it's called Johannesburg instead of Gauteng. And effectively, Cuomo had run that thing, and by all accounts, he's kind of a good old-fashioned Democrat, big spend, big infrastructure, also considered to be a little bit of a tyrant, some issues with some of his family members, giving him favorable coverage, perhaps shouldn't have been in the media, but nothing world-beating. And then he had a problem during COVID because New York didn't handle the COVID crisis particularly well. And Cuomo, in particular, seems to have, I believe that the scandal was that he decided to send a bunch of old people into an old age home where they would have been safer not having done that. And as a result, a lot of people died. A lot of people were very angry. There were big lockdowns. Lots of people, New York was particularly hard hit by COVID and all of that sort of COVID politics. So that was a huge issue and made a lot of people very angry. And then I think that sort of got parlayed, if you like, into something of a sex scandal, which had nothing to do with the COVID, but I think people were angry. There was some kind of scandal that he was involved in, which ended up meaning that he was taken down. So you had this combination of a guy who sort of had an autocratic management style, made some mistakes during COVID, is just a Democrat, and so is kind of more policy orientated, heavily on the government. And then also you had the sex scandal. That was the final straw. So he dropped out of the New York governorship and was around for a couple of years and then decided he's going to run for mayor. So he's on the one side. The other side is this guy called Zohran Mamdani. Zohran Mamdani. And he is kind of interesting because he actually has a South African background. His dad was Mahmoud Mamdani. And Mahmoud actually was a lecturer at UCT for a while in the 90s. He was one of the first lecturers to try and what they like to call these days decolonize the curriculum. That caused a major kerfuffle and ended up with him being kicked out of UCT for like 20 years. And he's also, because he's a post-colonialist scholar, you know, he has all these sorts of positions which perhaps you might expect one of these sort of extreme left scholars to have. So he, for example, only blames the genocide in Rwanda on the colonists from Belgium, and he didn't believe that 10 years ago there was a genocide in Darfur, in Sudan. He does believe that Gaza is undergoing a genocide, unsurprisingly. His most recent book is a revisionist history of Idi Amin and why Idi Amin might have been not as bad as people had first suspected, which is, you know, kind of bizarre. And, of course, is very, very anti-Israel in his views. Was kind of famous when he wasn't doing highly politicized stuff, which is thinking about how people were under the state and how that related to them. So that's his dad. His mother is a filmmaker, has done some Hollywood stuff. And after living in Cape Town for a bit and getting kicked out of UCT, they came to New York. And in New York, there was they grew up in Brooklyn and Queens. And Zohran Mamdani, he was a bit of a comedian for a while. He helped on his parents' campaigns. He didn't really distinguish himself all that much. But then he got himself elected as a council member of New York State. I think he may have been a council member of New York City, actually. Regardless, that's what he was a council member. It doesn't seem to have too much of a distinguished career there. One of the things he he did pioneer was a piece of legislation that would criminalize people making donations to something that would be considered over the Green Line into Judea and Samaria, although it's not clear exactly what that might be. It never went anywhere because it is New York politics, which is quite pro-Israel. And so that was it. But then he decided to run for the elections. Now, he's not actually a member of the Democratic Party. He's a member of something called the Democratic Socialists. And the Democratic Socialists kind of try and influence policy leftward, and they put him in as a candidate. And he sort of went on the kind of affordability track. That was his target. He said New York is too expensive, which it is. I mean, it is an extremely expensive city to live. And he wanted to try and fix this problem, and that was what he ran on. And which is fine, except his policy prescriptions is basically just to turn the New York City municipality into one giant ATM, into a giant ATM, and then spend on everything. So to make buses free, to make childcare free, to make he wants to do rent control so people can't change the rents on their properties. He wants to do all sorts of stuff to do with climate change. He wants to restrict certain kinds of educational opportunities for private schooling and only do public schooling. He wants to basically do an NHI for New York City State, so there's a single-payer monopoly healthcare system. He doesn't want to defund the police, although that was previously his thing. Now he just wants to send in healthcare people who like mental health officers, basically. So if you have a crime scene and someone has a problem, then they'll send in a mental health officer to go and deal with the problem, not a person with a gun. And these are just some of the things. Now, Zoran also has a long history of foreign policy issues. But you know, he doesn't like people, the dictators of Cuba and Venezuela, but is not prepared to sanction them. He thinks Narendra Modi, of the Prime Minister of India, is a war criminal. But his particular hatred, unsurprisingly, is for Israel. He was a key member of something called the Students for Justice in Palestine, which is basically the sort of student BDS group over in the United States. They were the ones who were responsible for this Tentafada thing that we had to deal with during the beginning of the war. He doesn't believe Israel has a right to exist. He's talked about linking any kind of failure that he will have in his mayoral campaign to Israel, to blame Israel for everything, regardless. He's talked about breaking the programs that help keep New Yorkers safe that work with Israel. And so he's talked about arresting Benjamin Netanyahu if he ever comes to New York for, say, the UN or something like that. So he is a radical, and he's very dangerous. And I think that he has tried to get people on his side by using this radical anti-Israel rhetoric, which normally would not be a problem and would, you know, kick somebody out. But because of the war, the public sentiment around the war means that you can say and do all sorts of things which normally would be much less acceptable. And so that is what's happening with Zoran in his campaign. And the problem is that Cuomo, because he's such an unpleasant figure, he's the nearest challenger. There's another guy called Sliwa Curtis, who's the Republican. The Republicans never win in these elections because New York is so Democratic. Sliwa Curtis seems like a decent enough chap, but he was kind of famous in the 1980s as a vigilante trying to solve crime by running around and supporting commuters. In a funny way, he wears a red beret, just like old Julius. And he is he's running as well. And the fact that these two can't figure out that if they don't come together to beat, to work together, then they're not going to beat Mamdani shows you how broken the system is, that this guy is just like continuously doing this. Incidentally, Mayor Adams actually pulled out and then endorsed Cuomo to try and give him a boost, and I'm sure the Trump administration will reward him. But it's kind of ridiculous. Normally in a Democratic election like this, or a heavily New York election rather, the Democrat runs away with the race. But in this particular instance, Mamdani really is not all that popular. And he says, you know, he said that he's got support in the Jewish community. What he means is you've got some sort of far-left Jewish anti-Zionist groups that he can that he can work with. And now he is, but really the Jews that he's working with are either these far left Jews who he went to go talk to, who were the ones said that, what was this? Oh, it's the congregation that he went to where yarmulkes were optional, but masks because of COVID were not. So you had to wear a mask in the shul, but if you didn't wear a yarmulke, that was fine. And then the other group are these Satmar groups who are extremely religious and sort of only believe that you can have a state of Israel when the Messiah comes. And so as a result, you have, he kind of has enough cover to say that, oh, look, he's supported by the Jewish community. Whereas, you know, most, if you looked at the primary race, he actually was not supported in two main areas, areas that were predominantly Jewish and areas that were predominantly African-American. So the question is going to be, will he be able to prevail using the current dynamics? He dropped in the polls in the last couple of days as people got figured out more and more what he's all about. But he is an extremely smart and extremely capable politician as a politician. And he's produced a lot of good social media and all of this kind of thing. And so he actually is the rank favorite to join and win the election. And if he does, then the sort of second largest basically Jewish community in the world from a numbers perspective at their biggest city will actually now be under the thumb of a democratic socialist with he's not an Islamist per se, because he doesn't want to impose Sharia law or anything like that, but definitely with a sort of strong anti-Israel leaning. So yeah, and that's going to have to be something that New York Jews and American Jews and the rest of us are going to have to deal with. Rabbi Kiedman has sent us a message saying he's enjoying the show and that the Republican is Curtis Sliwa. I mispronounced the name, so thank you so much, Rabbi, for sending me that. So yeah, that is the case, and we'll have to see where the New York City elections go. I think it's going to be a fascinating race, even if it is somewhat disturbing. We know in this country, when you had sort of anti-Israel politicians, we ended up with a statue of Mandela in Ramallah, which we had to pay for as South Africans. So goodness knows what a real politician might actually end up doing. Now, let's move on to another topic, same, but different, as they like to say. Dr. Paleng Mofokeng has gotten into somewhat of a bother recently because of things that she said. So Dr. Mofokeng is the UN Special Rapporteur on Health, and she has a whole range of radical positions. I don't know how she got into this position, but she has a whole range of very radical positions. She's on prostitution and abortion and all sorts of things where she's kind of not necessarily trying to say, well, this should be regulated or supported. She's like right out there and doing all sorts of things on these things. And basically every radical health position that you can think of, she's taken it to the extreme, and she's the rapporteur on health. Local South African doctor. Of course, because she has all sorts of radical positions, she also has a radical dislike for Israel. And she has been, during the war, a big part of the South African government's campaign at the ICJ. A lot of reports that the ICJ cites come out of her office. She's kind of like an Albanese type figure, and she basically, you know, she is still a UN diplomat. And so the other day, she 5 or 6 months ago, she got into a fight or something on Twitter and basically started using the F word against Benjamin Netanyahu on Twitter, which is not very diplomatic. And so then when Hillel Neuer from UN Watch actually called her out on it and said, this is really unacceptable and you can't say things like this, she's called him an evil white man who was scum and told him also to, you know, I can't say these sorts of things on the radio. And so that was what she did. And as a result of that, the South African Lions Federation actually laid a complaint with the Health Professions Council of South Africa, which regulates how doctors operate, because she is a doctor. And as a result, she's actually been convicted for bringing the profession into disrepute and has been fined 10,000 rand. And this has caused a bit of a minor storm on Twitter. People are very angry. They say, why can this happen? I mean, doctors get this all the time. If you're a doctor, you actually have quite strict ways in which you can and cannot speak during COVID. Certain kinds of doctors the complaints were laid against them, for example, for their opinions on the COVID vaccine, etc. And so doctors are actually quite heavily prescribed in which they can say and certainly the ways in which they can speak. And certainly as a diplomat, she certainly has those as well. So the HSPCA has done this. People are incensed. The EFF is very angry. They sent out a very aggressive letter about this. And so that was what happened. And now she's appealing it. But I think it will be an important test case to see whether the HSPCA, that sounds like, I feel like doctors are wild animals here for a second, but whatever. If they're going to stand by their original decision, or are they going to cave to potential pressure from very angry woke doctors who don't like having to follow their own rules? We'll have to see. We don't know what will happen, but we will find out. And we'll also find out what's coming up in the show after this, because we're going to take a break. I'm Benji Shulman. This is 101.9 High FM.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 High FM. I'm Benji Shulman. This is the New Blue Review. Welcome back to the show. Good to be with you on this Monday morning. Now, the Jewish community, particularly in Cape Town, but I think around the community, was gripped last week by the question of UCT, because a big issue had come up over time that had finally come to a head. And by a head, I mean a court case. And that was being heard in the Cape Town High Court. And it was a big deal. And if you haven't quite been following it, well, listen in. This is a summary that is coming your way. So what are we talking about? So basically, UCT for a long time had wanted for a number of years to take a resolution against Israel. They wanted to do a boycott resolution as the university, that they wouldn't do any research with any Israeli institutions. And so that was what they wanted to do. But initially they were just thrown out. The council said this is a ridiculous idea. The Senate rejected it. And it sort of died in around 2018 or 2019. But with the war, this sort of became a bigger issue again, and it got back onto the agenda. UCT was going through a bit of a bad moment with leadership-wise, so these sorts of things could kind of slip through the system. And in 2024, there was a resolution that was taken to have to deal with this problem. And the council said, no, we are going to boycott Israel. Now, the crazy thing about this resolution, first of all, is that UCT has no official institutional relationships with Israel to begin with. It just doesn't exist. And yet they decided they wanted to take this preemptively. That's how much they felt that it was important to do. At the same time, there's a bit of an issue because agreements that they sign to do certain things require, for example, that they adhere to certain conditions, that they adhere to what's known as the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, that they don't do limits on academic freedom, etc. And they seem to have gone ahead with this decision without really telling the people who are on the, were on the council that this was actually part of the process. And as a result, they were basically the agreements that they had lapsed. And this wasn't just agreements with donors that were worried about academic freedom, but also with other countries, with Germany, with America. It was all a bit of a disaster. And as a result, it depends how you measure it, but UCT could be losing anywhere between half and three quarters of a billion rand. Half and three quarters of a billion rand, including the loss of a teaching hospital that was going to be built, and the loss of 200 plus bursaries through different donors that were going to the university. Now, bear in mind that UCT likes to talk about itself as transformational, and they want to help people, whatever, whatever. But when it comes to this, they were willing to sacrifice young, underprivileged students for the purpose of a resolution about relations with Israel that they didn't have. And I think the real reason why this was pushed through is that research that has been done actually by members of the BDS team suggests that UCT is actually, although there's no institutional engagement, they do have other engagements with Israeli academics. And in fact, they do the most research with Israeli academics, I think mostly because they're very strong in healthcare. And in healthcare, what happens is that you get these teams from like countries around the world. You'll get 30, 40, 50, 60 doctors all at once who are all working on something in their regions because you've got to test things where they are. And as a result, you find that Israel is part of that. And so there's a lot of research that South African researchers end up doing with Israeli researchers. And so I think that the people saw this, they understood it, and they wanted to block it. And now they have. And now, as a result, South African doctors are starting to pay the price, including actually the people who organized the boycott in the first place, which is insane. And so after all of this, a number of academics, particularly the academics from the Jewish Studies Center, said, look, we can't do our work if this thing is done. And so we're taking you to court. And after quite a long process and lots of lawyers, et cetera, they now were in a position to do this. And we had the court case. And the whole court case really was revealed before us to show the process that UCT had undertaken and how they basically had paid no attention to corporate governance, no attention to the students and stakeholders would be effective, and they just pushed it through because they are ideological and anti-Israel. And by the way, this three quarters of a billion rand decision, it was basically taken by one vote, including, it seems, in the most disgraceful manner by the person who unfortunately is a Jew, who represents the donors. So the person who represented the donors, Diana Yach, she is supposed to represent the interests of the donors and getting money into the university. And she took a decision that she knew would cost half a billion to three quarters of a billion rand. And this is what's come out in the documents that that have been displayed in front of the court. And we will now see, we don't know how long these things take. It could be 6 weeks, it could be 6 months. Whether this gets overturned in court because of the incompetence of the council. And if it does get overturned, then really there's going to be questions to be asked about the council members who took this decision and whether they offered to be on UCT Council in the first place, because it certainly seems that they are prepared to put their very narrow political interests above the interests of the actual university and those students there, which is their job, right? No one's telling them they couldn't say anything. UCT could have come out with a a very strong statement, as other universities did. They could have made their selves known. But what they decided to do was go after the one key thing that a university is supposed to do, which is research and collaboration with other people for the generation of knowledge. And they were prepared to sacrifice that on the altar of their political priorities. And I think that that is going to be basically the legacy of this particular group of people on the council. Interestingly, and I don't know if it has anything to do with this, but the Irma Stern Museum, which is also something that is connected to UCT and also had an Israeli connection because of various Jewish, Irma Stern was a Jewish artist, and various Israelis were interested in her work. They also decided to close that down sort of very suddenly. So that is another interesting side note, although I don't know if it has anything to do with the case. So that is UCT. I'm Eddie Shulman. This is 101.9 High FM.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 High FM. I'm Benji Shulman. This is the New Blue Review. And you may have picked up in the news that Donald Trump, after his meeting with Xi Jinping from China, has restricted the access that he has, or people have, to chips, AI chips, that or computing chips that are needed for AI, rather, and kind of constricted them to American businesses and certain kinds of exports. In other words, he's trying to make sure that the Chinese don't have as much access to AI as the Americans, because they want to keep their edge there. And really, chips and AI have become the kind of critical mineral of the 21st century. And NVIDIA, which is a massive company that deals with this question, just unveiled their new chips, the BlueField 4 and the ConnectX 8 Super NIC chips. If you're a technology person, you will know that what that means. I have no idea, but it seems like they are very big and important, and I don't want to mess with them. And these chips are going to be leading the AI revolution from NVIDIA, which is one of the biggest companies actually in the NASDAQ. I think it's the NASDAQ that is the, or the S&P 500, whichever. It's one of those big exchanges in America where they make lots of money, and it's one of those companies that's alongside Alphabet, and which is Google, Microsoft, Oracle, and various Elon Musk type institutions that are getting together to power the future in AI. Now, what's interesting about these chips is that they are developed in NVIDIA's R&D center in Tel Aviv and are designed to accelerate data transmission, inference processing, huge AI models, which is the things that are helping things like ChatGPT and all of these AI things that are busy doing. Students work for them at university and writing appalling adverts for us, and even doing stuff on radio. So that they're really powering all of these sorts of things. And Israel really is in the forefront of helping to engage these things and develop them. And I think it's an important thing to see, because for all the talk that the war and the boycotts and all of this have, Israel finds itself right in the middle of the key technology that is going to really define the future in some respects of trade relations, of technology, of everything that has to do with the way in which we create information in the world in the coming years. And it shows why some of this kind of boycott stuff is so actually ridiculous. So really, yeah, that's the key thing. And we'll have to see where it goes. But the key thing is going to be to keep Israelis in that field, in the high tech, keep their advantage there, and make sure that they are going forward with that kind of stuff, because it really is a sort of key element in the way in which foreign policy and geopolitical policy is coming together. And that brings us to the end of the show for today. Thank you so much for everyone who helps put the show together. Craig, who pushes all the big red buttons, Vusi is on the sound. And to you, dear listener, who joins us every single week, do join us again next week on the New Blue Review.